T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Score Rewind. Playing back the best that you missed today on The Score.
Contreras, Joe Osho, Sports Radio 670, The Score. Thanks for hanging out on this Monday evening. Bad news for Sox fans. They lose at Detroit 5-1. The Sox are now one game below 500 with an 8-9 record. The Tigers are 9-5, folks. Those were supposed to be free wins. Tigers 9-5. Small sample size theater it is. And this is what we talked about going in. This could happen. You could have some really bad teams in the playoffs. Detroit could absolutely be in the postseason. Now the Sox are back below 500. They're losing 2-3 to the Indians, and they're losing the first one in this set in Detroit. Broadcasting live from the Score Hyundai Studios, brought to you by your local Hyundai dealers. Joe Ostrowski with you, and let's go to Mac and Parkins to start off Score Rewind right here on Sports Radio 670, The Score. College football, the story of the day. We wake up to hear multiple reports that the Big Ten is canceling fall sports, or are they? Because then coaches come out and they're saying, hey, we want football. Nothing official is out there. Kirk Herbstreit saying they just want a delay. So what's the real deal? Well, Teddy Greenstein stopped by this afternoon. It was Danny Parkins doing the show solo. And they started out by talking about those reports from the AM, including one from the Detroit Free Press. Take a listen.
Well, it's interesting, Danny. You know, the Detroit Free Press reported this morning that it was a done deal, which would not have been surprising. But a bunch of us then turned to our sources who said, nope, the vote has not officially been taken. And ever since then, you see this groundswell. You see Jim Harbaugh and Ryan Day and James Franklin and most notably Scott Frost come out and say that, hey, we're not buying this. We're not going along with this. Scott Frost at Nebraska saying, we'll play whoever. I mean, they're basically threatening to leave the Big Ten for the season. So if you're Kevin Warren and some of these Big Ten leaders, this is a nightmare scenario. And I'm sure they wish they had just pulled the plug, you know, yesterday or this morning, because then you really wouldn't have been able to have this public debate that's going on right now.
So that's what I'm wondering about. Is this just the, you know, the horse has already left the barn, and now Ryan Day and Scott Frost and those guys are just doing this publicly to show support, like, hey, we wanted to play? Because I have to imagine that they have voiced this opinion to university presidents and conference commissioners privately before today. It feels like a last-ditch desperation effort before the news actually comes out saying it's all canceled.
Well, it is exactly a last-ditch desperation effort, but, you know, the vote hasn't been taken. So just as the players wanted their voices to be heard, now the coaches are saying our voices should be heard. They want to give these presidents something to think about before they, you know, do something that is going to affect their lives, their livelihoods, and probably lead to, you know, mass layoffs in the athletic departments.
So what do you think ultimately happens in the next 24 hours?
I mean, I think the Big Ten still cancels the season. You know, I would have said it was 99.9% at about 9 this morning, less so now. But I think, like, even in the case of Jim Harbaugh, sure, he's saying that we should play football. And to your point, Danny, I think part of it is a show. He wants, you know, support the players, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, Michigan's president, you know, has a medical background, and he's the one who came out in May basically saying this probably isn't a good idea. So sometimes there's a disconnect. Now, the Nebraska element is fascinating. I don't think the Big Ten is going to say, hey, if you want to leave us for a year, you can play. do they have lawyers going through the contracts? Is there anything, you know, in these contracts that addresses a case like this? If 13 don't want to go and one does, or 10 don't and four
why
do?
Is that uniquely Nebraska? Is that just because they are the most vocally in support of playing, or why Nebraska?
Yeah. You know, when you look at the governor of Nebraska aligned with Trump, and you look at Senator Ben Sasse, who comes out today and says, hey, I've written this letter to the Big Ten officials saying don't cancel college football. And then you've got Scott Frost. I mean, wow. The stuff that he said publicly, and this is stuff that Nebraska put on its own Twitter feed, basically saying, yeah, we want to play. We'll play whoever, you know, we're ready in a week. So this is amazingly strong stuff. You know, Dan Patrick had reported that also Iowa was among the 14 that did want to play, that it was a 12-2 vote. And again, if there hasn't been a vote taken, I don't know how it can be 12-2, but I don't think Dan made that up. I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. But everybody feels, including a coach I spoke to today, that the Nebraska element, you know, makes the most sense, that they are the farthest sort of right. They are the farthest outlier on this issue.
Teddy Greenstein from the Chicago Tribune is our guest. What do you say, or what are your sources saying to the argument of, hey, if campuses are going to be open and these are student athletes, surely the football players, the student athletes, would be safer in an ecosystem of playing
sure.
sports where there are going to be, even if we don't know all of the protocols, there's going to be more testing. There's going to be more protocols for safety for student athletes than there will be the general population. So if campuses are open, we may as well have extracurricular activities like college football. What's the response to that? Is it liability?
Well, I mean, half of that is absolutely true. You know, I mean, Pat Fitzgerald has spoken about this. He doesn't want to see it canceled because, yeah, right now he's got all his players. They're tested. None of them are positive. They're working out. As he says, they're making great decisions at night. They're spending time together. They're staying in shape. They're doing all the things that coaches want them to do. The last thing any coach wants is like, hey, guys, the season's canceled. See you in a couple months. Have a great time tonight. Obviously, they lose control, and it's not good for these athletes to fall out of shape or get COVID. I mean, that doesn't help anybody. So that is certainly an argument for playing. An argument against playing is that just mathematically some of them are going to get COVID, and if you believe now, you know, this potential for long-term heart issues, or just at least the uncertainty involved with COVID, some of them might be damaged long-term. So it's probably dangerous to play. It's probably dangerous not to play. And that's one of the big reasons why we're faced with, or not we, why these Big Ten presidents are faced with a brutal decision.
And a texter is already coming in and saying, hey, there it is, the media making it political again. Geez, I think it's worth pointing out that the president of the United States himself tweeted hashtag we want to play and retweeted Trevor Lawrence about an hour ago. Teddy, obviously this is a massive story, okay? I'm not dismissing that, right? The idea of the Big Ten canceling college football and the 2020 season being this disrupted amidst the pandemic is by all accounts a massive tier one, page one story. However, I feel like there is potentially a bigger story happening here. Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields tweeted an action letter, basically. I don't know what else to call it. I'm going to just read it. We all want to play football this season. Establish universal mandated health and safety procedures and protocols to protect college athletes against COVID-19 among all conferences throughout the NCAA. Give players the opportunity to opt out and respect their decision. Guarantee eligibility whether a player chooses to play the season or not. Then here's the big one that I would argue is maybe a bigger story. Use our voices to establish open communication and trust between players and officials, ultimately creating a college football players association representative of the players of all Power Five conferences. I would posit to you, Teddy Greenstein, that bigger than any one conference's season being canceled in 2020, the bigger story here is Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, and apparently a bunch of other players are setting out to fundamentally challenge the foundation of amateurism in college football. Do you agree?
I heard your last segment. I did a little spying to prepare for this, Danny, and you made a very good case, there's no doubt. I just don't happen to agree with it. I think part of why the Big Ten folk and Pac-12 and other leagues down the line are going to cancel football is there's no doubt they don't want to deal with it, this whole component, especially in the Pac-12 where the players are actually threatening a boycott and demanding revenue share. But I think once this ends, like, so let's say, let's fast forward 11 months. So we're next July, we've got this thing under control, we got the vaccine, things are looking good, college football is coming back.
Yep.
I don't think there's going to be a big threat from the players because I think they realize that in all, that it's a very, very good deal that they have. Like when you consider scholarship, room and board, unlimited food, stipend, you know, career training, marketing, tutors for academic support, mentors to help you get jobs, parents get reimbursed for postseason trips, Pell Grants if you really need them. I mean, look, 10, 15 years ago, they were getting hosed. And especially like the coaches who were only given one-year scholarships who were holding that over the heads of players. I mean, they ruled the roost. The players have so much power now. Also, probably 90% of them realize they're not going to play in the NFL. So they're going to threaten to boycott and then just never play football again. So I don't see it. I could certainly see where rules are loosened. And if you're Trevor Lawrence, you can leave for the NFL after a year or two. I mean, I think that would be fair. But I think most college football players realize, you know what, we have a good deal, and we're not going to blow it.
You don't think – see, I think what you laid out then, the case on your side, and I'm glad you prepared for it very well. I just think that we're seeing it with athletes in the 21st century in terms of activism. It's not the outlier anymore. It's not just – Muhammad Ali and Bill Russell and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I mean, Pat Mahomes is 2 years into the NFL and he's teaming up with LeBron James on a voting rights initiative and getting Roger Goodell to look into a camera and say Black Lives Matter. Like Joe Burrow came out today in support of NCAA athletes and said if this was just 1 year earlier, he'd be looking for a job right now. Like I think athletes are realizing the true weight of their power at a younger and younger age. And maybe it's not like, hey, we get a salary out of this or we get a true revenue share, but the ability to profit off of image and likeness and the blowing up of the Olympic model where they can do a commercial for a local car dealership because because you're right, 90% won't go to the NFL. So like to that point, for 90% of them, their earning power and earning potential is actually the highest it will ever be in their football career in the 3 years that they're on campus playing football.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned name, image, and likeness, because if I had prepared a little better, I would have mentioned that too. I mean, that's in the process of being implemented. So guys like Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields can hopefully make a pretty penny by staying in school, and then they can't really say they're being exploited if they're making, you know, 500 grand on the side in endorsements. So
100%. And if that happens, if that actually happens, I think that will be, you're not going to hear much more of this. Like if guys can be who they are, they can be in commercials, they can sign autographs, they don't get suspended for taking a hook up at a tattoo shop or selling their Big Ten championship jersey on the side. And there's the video game is, you know, Lawrence 16 instead of QB 16 Clemson. Like, you know what I mean? And it's, you go into the university gift shop and it's jersey number one instead of, you know, the guy's name on it. Like,
yeah.
I think if we get there, the conversation about how exploited these kids are basically ends.
Yeah, that's the final piece. And so maybe all this will push the NCAA to approve it. But, I mean, the NCAA really already has. I mean, the NCAA says name, image, and likeness is fine. I think it's just now up to the schools to figure out a way to do it where they feel like it's not going to be used as a total recruiting advantage where Ohio State could say, you signed five autographs and we get you 500 grand and you know, another school that's competing for a player can't match that up. And obviously some people have no problem with that because it's not a level playing field now to start with. But you've just got so many players who aren't Trevor Lawrence or Justin Fields who are not going to boycott. Like a tweet is very different from saying, okay, I'm not playing Saturday. These guys are dying to play.
You're right. So what do you think happens with the SEC?
Man, I don't think the SEC is going to play, but certainly going to hold out a little bit. I mean, I think the SEC likes the reputation of it means more. And let's see what its coaches say. I mean, right now we have, you know, four Big Ten coaches out of 14, at least at the start of this interview, who are publicly saying we want to play. I mean, what if 11 SEC coaches come out and say we want to do it? You know, the Big 12 also, the Big 12 seems determined to try. I think ultimately none of them play, but it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out.
Yeah, man. And I think the political point, much to the texter's chagrin, like Big 12 country, conservative country. SEC country, conservative country. Like it is very likely to break along those political lines. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if they give it a shot. I just would love to hear one of them offer up an explanation, like what happens if a player gets sick and die from COVID. Like, they'll have a liability issue on their hands, would they not?
Yeah, I mean, like, Mississippi State and Mike Leach are not going to feel the same about this as athletic director Jim Phillips at Northwestern.
Right.
Part of it is the school. Part of it is the area. Part of it is politics. The liability part is interesting, Danny. I mean, in some ways, you could make a case that the only reason we're trying to play college football is because of money. Like Scott Frost put out there that Nebraska could lose $80 to $120 million, to which a very clever tweeter responded. He tweeted, leave it to Nebraska to overvalue its program. I thought that was pretty good. But you can make a case that the only reason we're trying to do this is because of money, and yet maybe money will be the ultimate reason this is not done, because of this fear of liability. Because you've got, you know, this Indiana offensive lineman, Brady Feeney, whose mom obviously had that, you know, impassioned Facebook post last week. And Brady right. came out today and said, yeah, I mean, this is serious. He went through 14 days of hell and is concerned with long-term damage from having COVID. These schools don't want to deal with lawsuits.
Teddy Greenstein of the Tribune with Danny Parkins this afternoon. Sports Radio 670, The Score. We woke up, we thought we had big news in the Big Ten. That's not the case right now. There's a lot of conversations going on behind the scenes. Over the next couple of days, we might get some official news, but not as of this moment. So we're still waiting which first Power 5 conference is going to jump and make some sort of a big announcement. We thought we were getting it from the Big Ten today and the Pac-12. That was out there too. Not the case. And Parkins is 100% correct. There's a reason many of us believe the SEC will be the last to say, okay, we're pushing things back. And you can make the same case for the Big 12. Joe Osho, Sports Radio 670, The Score. White Sox are back below 500 after losing at the Tigers by a score of 5-1. Some poor defense out there tonight, and it hurt them. The offense also scoring one run. You're not going to win a lot of games. Let's talk about the Sox next on Score Rewind. We will hear from TV analyst Steve Stone in his appearance on the Mully and Haas Show. That is next on 670 The Score and the Radio.com app.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
Score Rewind, playing back the best that you missed today on The Score.
White Sox are 8-9 on the young season, or is it a young season? We're talking about being 17 games into a 60-game sprint. White Sox lose at the Tigers by a score of 5-1. The offense really, really struggled. Just taking a look at the lineup here. Grandal was out once again. James McCann was in. He was 1-for-4. Danny Mendick, when he's your best player offensively, there's some problems here. He had 3 hits on the day. Want to find out about these injuries, though, because I know Abreu and Lourie Garcia both exited the game. Didn't Lurie get hurt? Was it over the weekend or yesterday when Garcia went down for a little bit?
I want to say it was at some point this weekend.
Maybe that was Saturday.
Too many.
I just established that, Julio. It was at some point during the series. Yes, it was. It's
too many to keep count.
You got that right. A lot of injuries in a short period of time, but I think a lot of us expected that coming after I guess, summer camp, whatever they were calling that thing after the long layoff. Joe Osho, Sports Radio, 670, The Score. Okay, speaking of the White Sox, let's go back to this morning on the Mully and Haw Show. Did you know Steve Stone's on The Score three times a week? Well, he is. He is, and his first appearance of the week was this morning with Mully and Haw. Take a listen.
I don't think anybody knows a particular team better than the broadcasters who do it on a daily basis. And Jason and I were both watching it, and we watched it unfold and watched, I think, the most unfortunate part of a game that went the other way was the rain delay came in because Brad Hand just didn't have it last night. I mean, you could really tell that if he stays in a game, I believe that the Sox are going to win that one. We hit Hand pretty well in Cleveland. We were certainly approaching him very well last night. And then the unusual rains came. Oliver Perez comes out of the bullpen. He's 100 years old, and he makes some good pitches, and it's over. But I think boys, what last night showed is that this Sox team, although greatly improved, if they don't make some critical plays in the course of the game, if they don't play a relatively clean game, it's going to be very difficult for them to beat a good team. They will beat up some mediocre pitching. They certainly will outpitch a few of the teams, but if they can't defend them, and there was a few plays that weren't made that could have been made, and
right.
that eventually did the boys in. So, I agree with Ricky in that the team came back. They battled. I mean, they made it quite a ball game. They retook the lead against a really tough Shane Bieber. In a situation where they needed to make a play, they didn't. And there was another factor, I think, that was critical in the ball game. You've got Grandal playing first base. We know that he's a catcher. You have a guy, and I mentioned this when we first started the series, you have a guy up in Delino DeShields who has bunted his entire career. If you go back and look at his body of work, he's one of the guys that will bunt when he gets an opportunity to do it. I think that because you have a catcher at first base, and I know Yasmani has played first base before. I'm not saying that he was, totally out of position. What I'm saying is he's not an everyday first baseman. I think you pretty much have to play him in on your doorstep, and if DeShields is going to lay down that bunt, you have to force him to try to lay it down to third base. It's too easy to push bunt up the right side, and eventually that was one of the key plays of the game.
Steve, Evan Marshall was very good this year. Last night just didn't have it. It just made me, I know it may not be cause-effect, but it just reminded you or underscored how much the Sox are going to miss Aaron Bummer, however long he's out. That was, of all the injuries, may have been the toughest one just because of the progress he has made and his value to that bullpen.
Like David, I know occasionally you look at my tweets, and a couple of days ago when it happened, I felt of all the injuries the Sox have had, and I tweeted that I feel Aaron Bummer was the costliest. That was the one that will have affected the team the most because very quietly, and I say quietly because he's not a surprise here in Chicago, but nationally they haven't heard about Aaron Bummer quite as much as they will. He was one of the best left-handers in the game of baseball. And certainly when he came in, he restored order into any situation he came in. He was a wonderful bridge to get the ball to Colome. He also took a lot of pressure off Evan Marshall, who's been terrific. I mean, look, it's unrealistic to assume he's not going to give up any runs anytime soon. Marshall made a bad pitch to Franmil Reyes, and it cost him. Reyes is a pretty good hitter we've seen, not only a slugger, but a guy who's got very good plate coverage. He got careless with one out over the plate, and it cost him the tie in the ballgame. But still, even after that, the boys were in a position to get it done. And they didn't. The play at third, Moncada got twisted around. He could have made a play. He didn't. There was some things that the team has to do that they didn't do. And somewhere along the line, I think it's a configuration of a lineup that you're going to have to live with. This team's going to strike out a lot. You've seen it. We've seen it early. Yet they play, they play good baseball, good enough to be 500. They played some good teams. Obviously, Minnesota's a very good team. The Indians, they've had two series against them. But think about striking out 11, 12 times a game. That's pretty much what this lineup, the way it's configured, is going to do. If you strike out 12 times a game, that means 4 innings. You make no contact. In 4 innings of a 9-inning game, you're guaranteed not to be able to score because you can't put the ball in play. Again, go back to the loss of Anderson and the loss of Madrigal. Very few teams thrive when your double play combination, who's just going to come together, is out. That's where they find themselves. And consequently, you have a lot of guys who don't put the ball in play. And 4 innings of every game, approximately 4 innings of every game, there is no contact. And I think that's one of the problems. And, you know, again, this is not the finished product. This is the fourth year of a 5-year stated rebuild. And the lineup will change. It will look a little different. But right now, no contact is really hurting.
When you look at the number of injuries, Steve, and, you know, particularly the pitching injuries, is it the wrap-up time? Is that what's the problem? I mean, I'm hesitant to think about anybody coming in who's had Tommy John surgery, because we've seen what happens when guys come in. And, I mean, look, I'm sure they're reaching down to Alabama to try to pull out their best pitch and fire it. It's hard not to when you're coming up and the adrenaline's flowing and you haven't been able to deal with that before.
We have a 6-week spring training in a normal year, and this year is anything but a normal year. They didn't have their full spring training when this game was shut down on March 12th. That's number one. Then when you come back, and I understand the philosophy of everybody involved, You came back, the negotiation to actually come back and play was longer than it could have been. And so when they came back, the spring training or summer training or whatever you want to call it was just under 3.5 weeks. That's not long enough. So my feeling is, and again, one of the things that I caution people about was that with an accelerated summer training to something that had been shut down and then laid off of for the better part of 4 months, you were going to have pitchers whose arms don't support the incredibly high spin breaking balls that everybody is employing these days. And that's one of the reasons, not the reason, but one of the reasons why we're seeing just a literal plethora of injuries to pitchers. And it's not only arms, it's legs. And if you have some leg issues, you're eventually going to have an arm problem. I think the history of baseball is littered with pitchers who have hurt the lower part of their body only to then see the upper part of their body start to give way, because you're all working in sync. If the legs are strong, the lower part of the body is strong. And if you think about it, guys, the biggest muscles in your body are from the waist down. And so if that can help support your pitching motion, the arm has to do less. When the arm has to do more, because the lower body isn't quite in as good a shape as it would have been with a normal spring training, I think you'll see more injuries. So, again, this is an extraordinary year. This is something I hope we never face again, because you're seeing the result of what happens when you have a situation where everybody wants to come back and play the game, but it was much less than ideal in the run-up to actual meaningful games. And you're right. Guys can't go out there and protect themselves. You can't protect yourself pitching to major league hitters if you're a pitcher. You have to go out and give it everything you have. Your body doesn't know it's not prepared, but it tells you when it breaks down.
Steve, the White Sox offense that we saw be explosive very early in the season now has scored 10 runs in its last 5 games. What has the league done to catch up the White Sox hitters, and how do they counter that?
Well, one of the things the league has done is schedule the Cleveland Indians against our boys. they have exceptional starting pitching. They have some guys out of the bullpen who are very good. But when you're facing the likes of Bieber and Plesac and Savali and Pletko to a certain extent, and Clevinger, I don't think that we've seen him, but when you're facing that rotation, you're just not going to hit a lot. They're one of the best pitching staffs and certainly starting rotations in baseball for a reason. They're awfully good. So I do believe that you get away from Indians pitchers, you'll probably hit a little bit better. That's number one. Number two is you have a lot of guys who are very anxious, and I think you see it occasionally, and maybe it's all reflected in Jose Abreu. Jose Abreu, if you look at the history of the last few years, he is in the top 3 in guys from the seventh inning or later driving in the tying or the go-ahead run. He is a very good clutch hitter. However, this has been the pattern with Jose. When the team is not doing it offensively, Jose tries to put everything on his shoulders and get it done himself. That leads to a huge strike zone. That literally leads to a nose-to-toe strike zone with every slider and curveball down and away. He's going to try to put it in play and drive home a big run. But he's proven conclusively that he can't do it himself, because when he expands his zone, he strikes out quite a bit. So you factor that in with Eloy, who was swinging it really well before he took a couple days off after diving into the seats. I don't know what happened in there, but he hasn't come back swinging it as well as he could. He will. Moncada is back and swinging it pretty well. I mean, he also had a late start because of COVID. So this team is just – right now they're just not getting it done. I assume this team is going to hit. I think they're really good. I think they're really going to produce. But put Anderson and Madrigal back in this team. Get these guys back together again. Maybe make an adjustment. See to it that McCann gets a little more play. I think the best that can happen is, for me, again, not Ricky or anybody else, for me, McCann having his bat in the lineup, primarily catching, and Grandal with his bat in the lineup, because it's a pretty good bat. Grandal either as a DH or as a first baseman, or do whatever you can, but it's nice when those two guys play together. I really like McCann behind the plate. I think he knows our guys real well. It's not Yasmani's fault. He's just coming to this team to get to know these guys. But, you know, there are certain things that that you know when you are familiar with pitchers. There's certain ways to get them out of situations that maybe somebody else can't. I think right now McCann is really familiar with all of these guys. Obviously, Giolito started to come to prominence with McCann behind the plate. I think we see when McCann does catch him, and Yasmani can catch him well. He's done it already this year. I just think it's a better thing with McCann back there. And we've seen personal catchers. I mean, Steve Carlton had a personal catcher. That was Tim McCarver. There are guys historically who have personal catchers. It's not necessarily a bad idea.
Steve Stone this morning on the Mullion Haw Show, Sports Radio 670. The Score. This is Score Rewind. Joe Ostrowski with you. Sox losers this evening at the Detroit Tigers with Dallas Keuchel on the bump, so they are now a game below 500 after dropping three of their last four. The big news throughout the day was college football. Here's ESPN's Adam Rittenberg about an hour ago. He tweets, not expecting any news tonight from the Big Ten per sources. More meetings in the morning, sources say. In all my years covering Big Ten, can't remember a day when the league seemed more divided, presidents versus coaches. Certainly could see presidents opting against a full postponement. That was clearly the battle that was going on. When it sounded like we were going to get an announcement, that never happened. And then the coaches went out. They said, we want football. We want football. So now what are they doing? They're getting the fan bases riled up. Let them play, right? Some players are saying, let us play. Fascinating to watch moving forward with Commissioner Warren. Don't think that. I wonder if that would have happened under Commissioner Delaney. I wonder. Joe Osho, Sports Radio 670, The Score. Speaking of college football, Anthony Heron was terrific with Dan Bernstein. Really strong stuff. You want to hear from him next. 670 The Score in the radio.com app.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station. Score Rewind. Playing back the best that you missed today on The Score.
Dallas Keuchel is not happy after the next loss to the Tigers. Take a listen to some of the comments. It will be a lead story in local Chicago sports tomorrow. Here's Keuchel in his postgame. It just seemed like we were taking the night off. We can't afford that with the young core we have here. We have to show up every day, and even if there are no fans, we have to make sure we are ready to go. And if we are not ready to go, we have to fake it until we make it. It seemed like today was one of the first games I've seen very subpar play from everybody. There's more from Keuchel. We just came out flat. I feel like we stayed flat the whole game. When you have enough talent to potentially win every game, it's very frustrating when you have games like this, and it seemed like we were out of it from the get-go. Dallas Keuchel speaking out against his brand new teammates after a loss to the Detroit Tigers. Joe Osho, Sports Radio 670, The Score, college football, big story throughout the day. And you're going to want to listen to this. Anthony Heron, who had Kirk Ferentz on the station over the weekend. He was doing a solo show on Sunday. I was glad to catch some of that. But here is Anthony Heron dropping by the Dan Bean Show today on Sports Radio 670, The Score.
What strikes me is I was talking about this a bit yesterday, the extremes of the discussion are pretty striking, because I don't necessarily have an issue with individuals, with players, with families, with main stakeholders, with the administrators making these decisions, having a different risk assessment than each other might have, or than I might set myself might have. But I think the factors that go into these decisions are sort of being, I think, misconstrued by a lot of the folks who are up in arms about the potential for a season not taking place, for a college football season being pushed to the spring or anything like that. Because folks aren't the guys and females who are making these decisions aren't sitting around scrolling Twitter trying to determine whether or not that's going to allow them to have a college football season, man. They're listening to epidemiologists. They've been meeting with each other about this for months throughout this calendar year. They're listening to economists. They're listening to lawyers. They're not scrolling Twitter looking at some op-ed in USA Today and allowing that to sway their opinion to any large extent. There's a lot more that's going on in those discussions that are having them determine whether or not they want to leave nine figures on the table this fall.
There was some confusion as to the players we want to play hashtag that then turned into something else. We heard from Trevor Lawrence earlier, but he and Justin Fields and some other prominent players were tweeting, "We want to play." And at that point, a lot of college football's cheerleaders came out and said, "Yeah, listen to the players, listen to them. They want to play." And then the players sort of set the hook and said, "Wait a second. We want to play. However, under these circumstances, with this kind of agency, with this seat at the table, with our voices heard," and all of a sudden the same people are like, well, we wanted to listen to you, and now don't listen to that part of it. And I'm wondering what the effect of that. I know they're not scrolling Twitter, but that the specter of a unified and empowered group of college football players has to affect what the ADs want to do now. Maybe they just want to shut it down and try to figure out how to deal with that on the labor front.
That's a huge piece of this, and that's really come, I think, more to a realization over the weekend here, where players, I mean, not even just over the weekend, but I think the united front that we're seeing that you're describing is the portion that really came more to a head over the weekend here. But of course, multiple weeks ago, Pac-12 players initially came out with their "We Are United" mantra, and then from there, the following week, Big Ten players came out with their Big Ten United mantra. And while there were different lists of demands to call, you know, unity demands was the term being used, different lists from each conference, but a lot of it came down to, we want to be on the field, but here's what will seem more equitable within these circumstances that we're in, these very remarkable times that we're in right now. Here's the health and safety protocols. Here's the finances. Here's the guarantees. Here's the removal of waivers or pledges, as it were, that some institutions were using as the name to describe it. And so these pretty comprehensive lists, and not all the demands made all the sense in the world, but it was entering into a negotiation essentially with a group who a lot of the players they don't necessarily trust will come to the negotiation with the best of intentions. So I think the players are swinging for the fences on some of these things. And now that the "We Are United," the "Big Ten United," the "We Want to Play" are all sort of super friend style combining forces, then yes, that definitely has the attention of the college athletic and the academic administrators also. And that to me is different than the notion that somehow they're necessarily just strictly paying attention to the media opinion on it, or the negativity that's out there about COVID in the media, as a lot of folks like to term it. But I think actually, because they have been meeting, like the Pac-12 has met with these Pac-12 players, Commissioner Kevin Warren from the Big Ten, he has had discussions specifically with the players from Big Ten United. So they're in communication with these groups already. And the more uniform, unified, the more voluminous the numbers get of players with their message, then that's the more power they end up wielding. It may not be in the midst of a season actually taking place this fall, but I think we are definitely seeing and continuing to see a pretty historic shift in the way that players influence their futures as amateur athletes.
I think notable that you went with the Super Friends analogy rather than Voltron, but it's certainly noted and appreciated. But when you mentioned epidemiologists, economists, and lawyers, I want to concentrate on the latest of those three, because it does seem to me when you start hearing people in charge, start hearing an AD or conference commissioner actually use the term myocarditis and say, well, now we're aware that even though somebody is asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic, that there could be issues with heart, lungs, or neurological symptoms that could expose them to massive liability and endless liability. This is not new. What amazed me was now we're hearing about it publicly from them as if this is new. It can't be true that they are just hearing about this now. It has to be that their lawyers have actually looked at where they stand and say, look, this is your exposure because of this now.
Yeah, and there's more examples of players who have been to the end. This is even just football players like Brady Feeney, an Indiana offensive lineman, like Xavier Thomas, a Clemson defensive lineman. Jaden Mitchell, I want to say Jaden, I'm forgetting his last name, an Arizona skill position player. There are players now more as we see more and more players being public with their voices about concerns. Also, we're seeing more examples of players coming out and publicly saying what they've been dealing with COVID and the effects that it's had on them. Now, that doesn't mean all of them are saying that they definitively don't want to play football anymore, but these medical concerns, which end up eventually becoming legal concerns if you allow the players back onto the field, all these are starting to come more and more to the fore. But you know, something like the Brady Feeney story that really initially came out last week when his mom put a message on her Facebook page, and you know, Commissioner Kevin Warren, he reportedly became very aware of that once it became public, and that's a big part of what continued to shift, I guess, his focus or his tenor on whether or not a fall football season was going to be tenable here. And where the Big Ten was the first conference to go out and say that they're at least going to adjust the season to go conference only, to recognize with an official maneuver that the season itself was going to be different. And now in the time since then, trying to take maybe a more methodical approach to it. You know, if folks had an issue with the Big Ten kind of going out on their own before, now the Big Ten seems to be trying to sort of, you know, get the Power Five group together in some unison here to make a maneuver. So, I mean, everything that's happening in the back channels, the back rooms, and as these conference commissioners are constantly in communication on calls with each other, I think the sort of titanic shifts in the finances of college football are going to end up reverberating for a long time by what happens this week.
Anthony, before we let you go, it was a great get to get Kirk Ferentz on the air. And in listening to that, especially after what we know about two separate inquests into racial disparities, to be kind, in the Iowa program, he sounded to me like a man who has spent a great deal of political capital to retain his position. And he comes across as someone who has stared into the abyss and has successfully been able to back away from it.
Yeah, I think that for him, the ability to retain the job, that part doesn't end up surprising me. I've been struck both in, you know, public communication and, you know, admittedly some private communication as well, with the level of legitimacy that Kirk Ferentz has given the concerns, the moments, the instances that players have voiced as this has all come out over the last couple of months, because it would have been very easy, and I think there's other personalities around college football that I think would have more likely sort of tried to push it to the side or use that political capital, to use your term, to sort of downplay it to a certain extent, or we're handling it internally. But he has been, especially for him and who he's been over two decades in running that program, very public about adjustments that he's trying to make within the program and adjustments that have happened for him in his perception of some of these things. So, you know, I think that overall it has been, while a difficult time for my alma mater, I think in the long run, this is all going to end up being a very positive thing, not only just as Kirk Ferentz finishes his time as a coach, however much longer that is, but just in the way that Iowa football fans and those who love and consume the program will end up needing to view issues of race within their football program, within their state. And it's certainly not over yet. Whenever they take the field again, one thing that was a bit of news where Kirk Ferentz had been saying, whatever we do, it's going to be a uniform approach. Everybody's going to stand, everybody's going to kneel, everybody's going to lock arms, whatever it is. Sounds like, as he told me yesterday, that's not necessarily going to be the case. There might be some guys standing, might be some guys kneeling, but one thing he did say is that the discussions amongst those players of differing views and approaches has been respectful. And I think that's just one example of how college football and the players and the teammates in that can be an example for how a lot of us in society handle our differences amongst each other.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.